This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Let me start with John chapter 11. And let's see where it goes. Shall we? So John chapter 11. Lazarus is dead. Pity. Lazarus is dead. Jesus was not there. Couldn't help him, right? It's too late to do anything about it. Martha, sorry if that's a little small there. Martha heard that Jesus was coming. And she went and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" And there is a question for you. Do you believe this? It's a difference maker whether you believe this. This thing we celebrate today, and all around the world Christians celebrate, the resurrection, it is simply this. It is the physical return from death of the man Jesus of Nazareth in the same body, fully restored. It is the physical return from death of the man Jesus of Nazareth in the same body, fully restored. And every part of that definition matters. It is the physical return, so that he was not a ghost or an apparition. They didn't have a vision. Right? It's a physical return from death. He wasn't just brutalized nearly to death and then somehow able to be revived or resuscitated. You know, the Apostles' Creed, we said it this morning in the sunrise service, makes the point. It says, "Crucified, dead, and buried." He didn't just, he didn't flatline for like 20 seconds and come back. So it's the physical return from death of the man, Jesus of Nazareth. I have 2 points here really with this one. One is that this is an actual historical person. This is a guy who grew up in this town, Nazareth in Galilee. He's not a mystery figure who just sort of appeared out of nowhere on the scene among people, kind of like fully as an adult. Like some strange and mysterious figures, you know, kind of just turn up. Well, this guy had a boyhood and everything. I mean, he's a real historical person. And the other emphasis of this is that he was, in fact, flesh and blood. As we sometimes say, Jesus was more than merely a man, but he was no less than a man. I mean, you know, the way you and I are physically put together, everything, that's the same. So of the man, Jesus of Nazareth, in the same body, okay, the same body, so like his spirit didn't fly over and inhabit a different body or sort of like take a new form. And he was not reincarnated. He didn't come back with someone else. It's the same body. I mean, they immediately recognized him. Well, and except for the occasions he didn't want them to, right? And he had the power to do that. But other than that, it wasn't like, "Hey, who are you anyway?" And he had to convince them, "I'm back in a different body." No, he was recognizable. So it's in the same body, but fully restored. So like, he didn't come stumbling into their camp all bloody and battered and gory. He didn't come, you know, it wasn't like it wasn't just him and his body after going through all that like a zombie. It wasn't the living dead. I mean, he's fully restored. He's pristine. He's in mint condition. The only scars he has are the remnants of scars that he intended to retain for a purpose, to make a point. Other than that, he's in tip-top shape. That's what the world celebrates. That's the cornerstone belief that we're singing about and reading about and talking about. This the resurrection, defined as such. And I want to say to you this morning about it that the resurrection is historical and historic. The resurrection is historical and historic. They're not interchangeable. There is a distinction between the words, which I know as you look at them, you will say to yourself, oh, I guess I've used those wrong. Hey, don't sweat it. That's just part of living in the age we live in. We get all kinds of stuff wrong. But point of fact, just to be technical about it, this is what these words mean. So something is historical if it is in, of, or concerning the past. If it ever happened. If it ever actually took place. It's historical. Including like 6 billion mundane occurrences that have happened since the beginning of time. They're all historical. You know, every owl that swooped down in the night and picked up a poor unsuspecting field mouse, that was a historical event. Right? It just wasn't all that meaningful. So everything that ever happened was historical. Things that never did happen clearly are not historical. Clearly. So, historical means that. But historic means far more. A thing is historic if it is important, if it really matters, if it's some kind of momentous event, some kind of meaningful thing that happened, not like the owl that came, not just, hey, a guy named Hank somewhere in Toledo brushed his teeth this morning. That is not a historic event. All right? Even though it's historical, it has no significance in life. It doesn't change anything. There's no real meaning in it. So the resurrection, I'm arguing here, is both historical and historic, which, of course, as you can already tell, your wheels are turning. There's a little bit of a redundancy here because, as a matter of fact, I mean, if they're related in the way that I say they're related, then anything that is truly historic, I mean, by definition, was historical, right? It could not have been a meaningful occurrence if, in fact, it never happened. Of course, the opposite isn't true. The opposite isn't true. All historic things are historical, but not all historical things are historic, as I already indicated. In fact, really, very, very few things that are historical are historic. Very few things. Think about all the every tiny thing that ever happened since the beginning of time. Most of them are inconsequential. Only a rare few could be deemed historic in nature. Only a few. But now, wait a minute. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a minute here. Couldn't there have been certain figures, like Jesus maybe, other figures of other kinds, who it turned out also there are claims made, and those figures could be considered important in history, like they could be historic in a way, without those things being historical. Isn't that true? For example, the cult leader Jim Jones, to take a case study. The cult leader Jim Jones. You probably know these stories. He made a lot of claims. I mean, he made more and more claims as time went on. And before it was all done, he was claiming to be Jesus and Buddha and Vladimir Lenin too, by the way. He was, because he was fond of what he called, divine socialism. What he called it? It was a Marxist ideology sort of veiled in his weird semi-Christian cultic beliefs. But Jim Jones is a historical person. This stuff happened. He really lived, and he really built his paradise commune out in the jungle that turned out to be such a paradise. Indeed, see, Even tragic events are historic sometimes because you don't forget them. They matter. They have meaning. I mean, the Holocaust is both historical and historic. I mean, it's not just any other thing that happened. But wait a minute. But the charge is, but that doesn't mean everything he said is true, does it? No. See, what is historic about him is the events that happened, those tragic events that happened, and everything that took place. But that doesn't mean every claim he made was true. Also, for that matter, fictional characters. Couldn't there be fictional characters who were in some ways historic, even though they're not historical? Isn't Hamlet a historic character? Isn't the Lord of the Rings trilogy a kind of historic, you know, piece of work? Isn't the first Superman comic kind of historic? Well, sure. Sure, but those things are historic as fictional characters or as stories or books or movies or first editions. They're historic as those things, not as themselves. Not as themselves. In other words, the signing of the Declaration of Independence is a truly historic event. But mankind's victory over the alien invaders in the movie Independence Day, not a historic event. Okay? Because it is not historical. I mean, if that happened, boy, that sure would be a pretty historic event, wouldn't it? But it did not happen, so it's not. So, okay, you want another one? The 1936 and 38 match and rematch of Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling were historic fights. However, the match and rematch of Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed in Rocky 1 and 2 were not historic fights because they didn't happen. Now, you could say Rocky's a historic film, but see, that's the film, not the thing, not the events that transpire. You could even say that within a fictional world, historic events might happen within that world. So, is it historic that Schmeagle and his friend find the ring at the lake? Well, in that fictional universe, that was a historic event. But it's not an actual historic event outside that universe, not in our world, because it didn't happen. So when I say now that the resurrection of Jesus is a historic event, I mean the event itself is historic. Not the preaching of it, not the writing of the story, not the believing of it by people, not the proclamation, not the impact of it, not the teaching of it and how it spread. I mean, some of those things could be historic in their own right, but what we're saying today is, and what we celebrate today is, that the actual event itself is historic. This is why I emphasized both of them. So, let me say a little more just about each one, maybe demonstrate it. So the resurrection then is historical. Okay, kind of the first of the two. It truly is historical. It happened. Many books are written, and somebody made a movie. And there are others as well, where it's been fairly well demonstrated that this is not a mythical event. Now, I don't badmouth mythology per se. Mythology is important. Mythology can have meaning in its own way. It's not itself bad. Nothing wrong with mythology. It's always taken as some kind of a pejorative. But this event is not in that category. It doesn't belong to that style of event, that kind of writing or anything. When the eyewitnesses see report a thing, now, over time, look, the sort of reverend reflections of people looking back, generations later, there is a tendency for kind of myth growing and myth making. You know, generations into the future. But when you have people existing in that time who were there when the principal events take place, eyewitnesses in many cases, that's not how that works. That's not time for myths to grow. Listen to how Paul describes this in 1 Corinthians 15. See if this sounds like a guy who's telling a grand mythological tale from ages past. He says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that He was buried, that He was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then He appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, some of whom," most of whom, he says, "are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then He appeared to James, then all the apostles, last of all, as to one untimely born, He appeared also to me." Does that sound like long ago, once upon a time, a certain man lived? No, this is very tangible. Sort of like, hey, last Tuesday a certain thing happened. That's different from long ago in a galaxy far, far away. The theology of the gospel now does contain timeless elements. There are timeless features of the gospel itself, such that, you know, they resonate across time, and they're sort of universal themes that you find all across all kinds of stories. And so mythology of different kinds contain these themes. Themes like the, you know, evil and the darkness of man and sin and death and trying to overcome death, trying to stave it off, trying to defeat it. The sacrifice of one person for another, the concept of atonement. All these things are woven into the fabric of lots of stories that are told. There are mythological elements, but that doesn't mean, see, that this actual account of this man from Galilee, that is. And so that is why men like C.S. Lewis and his pal Tolkien, whose story I've already mentioned, these are guys who were trained experts in mythologies of all kind. And you know what they said about it? They said, in this account, life, death, and resurrection of Christ, they said myth became fact. Myth became fact. So that all of these grand themes that have been planted into the hearts and minds of people sort of find their flesh and blood avatar. They all find their embodiment in real time and space in this account. See, the followers of Jesus, as Pete shared about this morning, by the way, we're making a lot of references to Pete. When I say 1 Peter, that's 1 Peter. When I say 2 Peter, but if I say 3 Peter, well, I'm referring, of course, to our own. Made reference to this earlier, talking about what these followers went through, what they were willing to go through to carry this, to have the energy and the fortitude to get up every day and leave your home, leave everything you ever knew, never to come back in many cases, carry this message across borders into unsafe places where you are definitely at risk, and most of them, nearly all of them, ultimately killed for it. It seemed a little strange that they would do that if they concocted it. I've quoted this before. The great Israeli historian, scholar, and rabbi, Pinchas Lapid, that's what he says, quote, "How can it be explained that against all plausibility, the adherents of Jesus did not ultimately just scatter and were not forgotten, and that the cause of Jesus did not reach its infamous end on the cross? How did it nevertheless come about that the adherents of Jesus were able to conquer this most horrible of all disappointments? When these peasants, these shepherds, these fishermen, who had betrayed and denied their master and then failed him miserably, could suddenly, overnight, be changed into a confident mission society, there's no vision, no hallucination sufficient to explain such a revolutionary transformation. Karl Barth said the resurrection is an event that could be safely reported in the New York Times. Not that the Times editors of today would dare print it. You'll remember in Acts chapter 4, we were talking about remember that message, how to get arrested, how to go to jail, how the apostles found themselves in the clink. They were hauled in then after they'd been preaching this message, causing a stir. People were believing and they didn't like it. They throw them in jail. Then they put them on trial. All the important religious leaders question them. And at the end of it all, they basically tell them, stop doing it. Please stop. These religious leaders don't like this movement. And incidentally, the resurrection that we all celebrate and sing happy day about, There are people in the world that do not think that it represents a happy day. And some people will hate the teaching. And even today, as I was informed this morning, that some worshipers in Sri Lanka, this is just ongoing. Some people will hate it. Well, the apostles, they didn't face a whole lot of appreciation and attaboys by the leaders for going out there and teaching this. Therefore, they were told, stop it, stop it, stop doing it. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to do whatever it takes. Stop this movement. We don't like this movement. But remember at the time I mentioned that the great scholar F.F. Bruce had a comment on this passage. And what he said is this. He said, it is particularly striking that neither on this nor any subsequent occasion did the authorities take any serious action to disprove the apostles' central affirmation, which was the resurrection of Jesus. Had it seemed possible to refute them on this point, how eagerly would the opportunity have been seized had their refutation on this point been achieved? How quickly and completely this new movement would have collapsed. You see what he's saying? They don't like the movement. They want to stop the movement. They hate the movement. They're trying every which way. But all they have to do is produce a body. And the whole thing's over. Show's over, folks. There's nothing more to see here. Go home. It's that easy. Well, why couldn't they do that? Theories have been offered in the past. All the leading conspiracy theories. Who took this body? It's the mystery of the body snatcher. Who took it? The apostles get in there. Roman authorities get in there. Somebody got in there. Joseph of Arimathea. What happened? That's all they would have had to have done. And so therefore, all this work's been done. Pete mentioned this morning the Strobel series. Those are very readable books. A little heavier duty. The resurrection of Jesus. And if you really want to go all in, I mean whole hog, if you've got a couple of years and probably about $70 to buy it, and maybe a dolly to carry it, you could get N.T. Wright's 800 plus page tome here called The Resurrection of the Son of God. And this is a world class scholar, and he doesn't leave anything out. I mean, it covers every possible facet of every possible element of the whole thing. Yes, it is a historical thing. But of course, that is assumed when I say historic. It is historical. But obviously, we're not here singing about it just because it's like anything that happened. You don't get together and celebrate the gajillion other things that happened in history, all of which were historical if they took place. But this one really matters. And so, the resurrection is not just historical, which is a prerequisite for what it really is most. It's historic. It is truly historic. The prophet Hosea records the words of Yahweh saying, I shall ransom them from the power of Sheol, which is the grave. I shall redeem them from death. O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where is your sting? Paul quotes it to the Corinthians. Let me give you some reasons why this is a historic event. It's a one-time only event. I mean, there's no miracle bigger than this, is there? There have been some charlatan preachers who have come along over the years, and they claim to perform resurrections. And you get some of this with certain televangelists. No. It's a lie. Those guys are not performing any resurrections. This is not a repeatable thing. We don't go around the world saying, bring in the corpses, we'll raise them all up. Now, you say, well, Jesus raised more than one person. Yeah, he had the power to do that. But incidentally, now those people were just given an extension on their already earth. They died again. They weren't raised up incorruptible at that time. So Lazarus comes forth, but, I mean, he just got a few more years. And he wound up back in a grave again later. No, this is a one-timer. Jesus' life is a high point. It's a kind of apex. All the histories, all the prophets back in all the ages, you know, they're pointing ahead on the timeline, looking ahead. And then ever since, all the church looking back. So if the life of Jesus is sort of the great climax of history, as Pete said earlier, that day, that single day then, the greatest single day, this is the seminal event. This is the grand of all miracles. This is the apex of even His doing. It is the high point of recorded history. And it's the ultimate sign. It's another thing. It's the, you know, all the miracles, and Jesus performed all the great miracles, cool things, people came to see Him. And He would always say these are signs, and John likes to call them signs. What does He mean by signs? It means they're not just parlor tricks for kicks and giggles, just so you'll go, ooh, ah. They have a point. They have a purpose. He's vindicating Himself. He's authenticating His own authority. And so, what's a bigger sign than walking out of your tomb? This is the ultimate sign. It vindicates all of His claims. He made bold claims. He was very audacious with His words, right? And if you can't do these kind of things, and you run around saying the kind of things He said, well then frankly, you know, you run your mouth kind of reckless for someone who's got no power to back it up. But this guy had the goods to back it up. He said all these audacious things, and everyone says, scandalous, I can't believe it. Well, I never. Well, I can't believe he would say it. But then he got up out of his tomb, you see. So it's a vindicator. It confirms his authority. And all religious beliefs settle on authority. They all come down to authority. It's the old question when you hear a teaching, who says, why should I believe this? Well, you sound like a skeptic. You're all skeptics, and rightly so. God has put it in you to be a discerning human being. Otherwise, you're a sucker and you believe everything everyone says. Anybody who comes along making any claims, you just believe it. But you've got to be discerning. And so there's a healthy form of skepticism that should rightly ask, who says? Where did this teaching come from? What is its source? What is the authority behind it? Why should I believe it? And if you had asked the early Christians, oh, I hear what you're teaching. Why should we believe this message that you have? They could have said, I'm glad you asked. Did I tell you the part about how the man was dead and then came back and was alive a few days later? And yeah, we saw him. And yeah, we talked to him. Did I get to that part? See, a guy who can come from his own grave and walk back out fully restored, I will listen to that man. I'm willing to believe that he may have real authority when he teaches what God is like. And we struggle sometimes with certain things and teachings, and so the Scriptures, for example. But consider this. Jesus believed the Scriptures. Jesus taught them. He quoted them. And if he who could beat death, right, if he who could go all the rounds of the fight with the reaper and the only guy to win, if he can do that, he believes the Scriptures, then I can believe the Scriptures. Their authority can be derived even just from him. The foundation and structure of all the teachings then can come down to this event, this the indispensable event. You can't do without it. You got nothing like Christianity without this event. It's the central miracle. Use the old Latin term. It's the sine qua non. You ever heard that one? It means without which, not. Without which, nothing. You do not have Christianity without it. It's the sine qua non of Christianity. Of all of it, you don't have it without it. Well, Paul again from 1 Corinthians 15 says this. If there is no resurrection from the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain. Your faith is in vain. And we are found even to be misrepresenting God, because we testified about God that He raised Christ. But we're liars. If Christ is not raised, he goes on to say, your faith is futile. And you are still in your sins. And also those who have fallen asleep, those we've lost in Christ, have perished. They're gone. If in Christ we have hope only in this life, we are of all people most to be pitied. If this event is not truly historic, if it never happened, so it's not historical, then you're all sitting here singing songs and reading words and listening, and really, it's all kind of pitiful. It's just pitiful. Because you don't have the hope you think you have. The resurrection makes the good news truly great. I mean, if you're going to take a message out across all the borders of the world into the faraway places, to all the different people groups of the world, you're going to take this message. What message is it? What makes it good? What makes it so powerful and amazing that you take it to the peoples of the world? Is it that we go to all the peoples all around the world and say to them, "You're all sinners"? Well, yeah, but they know that. You're just reminding them of what they know. Or that, you know, the world's a terrible place and there's sickness and there's sorrow and you've got to contend with that. They know that. Or to tell them you've got guilt and you got to deal with your guilt. They know that. Most of them are making animal sacrifices to some deity. They've got a sense of their guilt. Or that, hey, guess what? Someday, you know, this life will pass. You will die. I mean, you can't live forever in this world. You will die. They know that too. You're just reminding them of the things they know. But when you get to the part about the Lord Himself, when you tell that story, and especially when you get to the part about how, yeah, you know, He was a great man, and they're impressed with that story, and they hated Him for it, and they might have a concept of why that could be, and they're threatened, and then they kill Him in a gruesome way, and this is a sad part of the story. This is very tragic. But then when you get to that last part, you see, when that kind of thing really comes to people fresh, unreached people who have never heard this before, it often registers with them with the appropriate sense of awe that you might expect. And missionaries will tell you this, that when they get to this part of the story, there's a fair amount of shock. People say, "Well, what? Run that by me again. He did what?" You know, they show the Jesus film in these places. The very famous Jesus film. Basically, it's the Gospel of Luke put on film, and then they dub in whatever language, and they put it on screen. And the people will get into this thing. You know, they get into this whole film. They follow it. They watch the story. And many times when it gets to that part, I mean, there's everything from audible gasps to people might faint or they cheer, you know. Because, see, the resurrection, puts the good in good news. It really, that's the payoff of the whole message. Some people don't realize we have a payoff. They're like, "You Christians going around the world telling everybody they're just a bunch of sinners. You're just carrying a bunch of bad news to everybody. What a downer." Yeah, did you finish the story though? You know, like how death is defeated? I don't know, that sounds pretty good. I don't know who would call that a downer. The resurrection gives you perspective on all of life. And for a Christian, see, this isn't just a holiday. Well, once a year we remember this, then we go on. No, for a Christian, this is every day. It gives you perspective in life. It's not like, you know, if you just experience the emotion of it, then you go back out. It's like seeing a movie. There are some movies because it gives you all this emotional payoff. You watch some movies because you want to feel that again. So I'm going to watch that again. And you get all the feels about the movie. And then, but you know, like when it's over, you go back to your life and all your problems. And that movie didn't help you. It doesn't offer you any answers and any help for all your problems in life. And then you'll forget about it for long periods. And like maybe next year you'll think, "I haven't seen that in a while. I think I'll watch that again because it gives me good feelings when I do." That's not what we're doing. You're not coming into church like this is the theater. And let's play the Jesus one again. It makes me feel so good at the end. It gives me a lot of good emotional payoff. Then I'll go back to my lousy life and have to somehow figure that out. No. This is how you figure that out. This is part of all that. This gives you perspective. You need perspective because life can beat you up pretty good. So everything you have to deal with, everything you experience, having a rough day? Well, Jesus walked out of his tomb. Having a bad year of it? Got some health problems? Well, there is the final full restoration of a new body, resurrection. Got that to look for. Politics got you down? Don't like the way it's going? The media and a news cycle is kind of a downer? Yeah, well, there was this man came out of his grave. See, perspective. You got to remind yourself of this thing. But everything we see in life, it's the lens through which you see everything now. And you'll see everything differently in the light of resurrection. That's how it ought to be. That's how it's meant to be. And then, see, this allows you to live the Christian life. Because without it, not only can you not really live the Christian life, without it, there's no such thing as the Christian life. Or there could be something called the Christian life. It would be altogether different. The Christian life would deteriorate into a fine kind of memorial to a great man that we remember. And there's a lot of great men we remember. But this would be different. I mean, this would be no different, I guess. No, the Christian life is contingent on it. And because of it, you can truly live the Christian life. Because of the resurrection, you can live well. You can live well. I mean, really live well. Not like the world has a concept of what the good life is and how to live well. And how exactly is that going for them? I mean, look around. The general concept in the world of what the good life is, it's not paying the dividends. It's faulty. That's not how to live well. Because of this, you live well. You live with real purpose. You live on the basis of truth. You live with hope. You've got real perspective. You live as someone who's wise, not a fool. You live without the guilt from all your sins following along behind you, dragging all that around. Without fear of anything. If you don't fear death, I mean, what do you fear? Without confusion and bewilderment and life and all of its big questions. Without being restless, looking for something. What's going to help me out? How can I drown my problems somewhere or another? And without this kind of stressful aimlessness people have, or this enslavement to people and things. I need everyone to like me. I got to please everybody. See, the good life is you're free of all that. The resurrection allows you to live well, the life God intends you to live. You will find true happiness in it. It allows you to live well. It allows you to die well. Yeah, it allows you to die well. You die without fear, without regret. You don't have to look back and hate everything that went by and have all the regrets you would have. I was thinking about this morning, we sang that hymn earlier. Christ the Lord is risen today. Now that's a good Easter one right there. It says, love's redeeming, is the third verse. Love's redeeming work is done. Hallelujah. Fought the fight. The battle won. That's how you die. Like he did. You fight the fight. And then you win. You know, you don't go into death regretfully trying to cling on and drag everything behind you. I got a picture to show you. Have a look at this guy. This guy here. You see, that's not how you do it. That's not going to work. And who wants it anyway? You've been dragging all that junk around from house to house your whole life. Aren't you ready to just be rid of it? Huh? Along with everything else? No, you can figure out how to die well. You can run the race and have the confidence and the hope of what comes after. And you can just, you don't have to fear it and run away. You can head for the old, you know, you can look at the shoals coming your way and say, hey, full steam ahead. You know what I mean? Fire the engines up. I'm gonna crash land this thing. All right? I mean, when the time comes, see, you've lived well and you die well. And then the best news is, you live again. That's the Christian life. That's the real message. That's what the resurrection means. This is what's available to you. You live well, you die well, you live forever. So we started in John 11. I'll end there again. Remember those words. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live.